This week on Making Contact.
We're seeing worse droughts in Texas and Oklahoma than we saw during the Dust Bowls, and obviously record droughts lead to record wildfires, which we've also been seeing. So what scientists predicted have come true.
Global warming is no longer a fear for the future. It's threatening human civilization now. But a significant portion of humanity doesn't seem that concerned.
We're not going to pass anything if it's either very economically harmful to the United States or if the developing countries didn't have to do the same thing that the developed countries.
On this edition, part one of a special two-part series produced by Brian Edwards Tekert on climate change that is happening, the political response that isn't, and the people trying to break the gridlock. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
I think what we'd see ultimately is a world without any polar ice, with sea levels maybe 60 meters higher than they are today. So we don't have any coastal cities anymore, you know.
That's Tim Flannery, author most famously of The Weathermakers.
This may all take thousands of years to happen. But, you know, on the way there, we'd see quite dramatic shifts in rainfall patterns, in temperatures, and, of course, then in food security for human beings, water availability. We'd see some sea level rise on the order of, you know, perhaps up to 4 metres within a century or so, disrupting low-lying areas. So there's lots of change, and change is the enemy of everything we've built up over this 10,000-year period of climate stability.
That's 10,000 years of predictable seasons, temperatures, and rainfall. Long enough for humans to settle down, develop agriculture, and build cities, which is something we had not managed in the previous 190,000 years. Flannery is a paleontologist by training. In his academic work, he studies fossils, not climate systems. But he says the fossil record has a lot to say about what has happened when the planet heats up quickly. And it sounds like science fiction. Imagine standing on the beach. The sky is green, the sunlight deadly, the ocean is purple, and it's belching clouds of poison gas.
What happens is that the ocean circulation is disrupted, and then there's no oxygen reaching the depths, and these rather peculiar bacteria, they're called sulfur bacteria, tend to multiply. And that dead zone comes higher and higher up as the oxygen's all used up, until finally it hits the sunlit layers of the ocean. And at that point, the world changes, because those sulfur bacteria then really take off and they start producing sulfur, which gets into the atmosphere, destroys the ozone layer, and then really destroys much of life on the surface of the planet. They think this happened 195 million years ago. There's some good evidence in the geological record it happened. It caused one of the great extinctions of all time.
Tim Flannery cites atmospheric scientists who say we've already crossed a tipping point. We have already changed the Earth's atmosphere enough that the planet will continue to heat up on its own. Unless we take drastic action to cool it, he says, and unless we do so quickly.
It's a bit like, you know, imagine taking a potentially fatal dose of a poison, yeah? So when you've taken it into your mouth, you've taken that potentially fatal dose. But it takes a little bit of time for your stomach to digest it and for it to get into your bloodstream and reach your vital organs. And once it's done that, that's the point of no return, right? So it's the climate system's a bit the same, you know? It looks like we've taken the fatal dose, according to Hansen, but it's yet to reach our vital organs. So we have to do something about it. We have to develop an antidote, right? Quick.
So, what would that antidote look like?
I have the pleasure of giving you now an overview of the study, which as...
Cancun, Mexico, 2010. It is the 16th Conference of the Parties to the Kyoto Protocol. This is the meeting where the world's nations are supposed to figure out how to stop climate change. And this is what they've come up with.
Inviting countries to declare how they would either reduce or control emissions by 2020, so-called pledges.
That's pledge as in non-binding commitment. Like a promise to give to a public radio station. When the bill shows up, maybe you'll pay it, maybe you won't. Negotiations to expand a legally binding treaty on climate change fell apart in 2009. The pledge system is what the world's leaders came up with instead. The official goal is to keep the planet's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees centigrade, which is still hot enough to put entire countries underwater. And Professor Joseph Alcamo, as chief scientist of the United Nations Environment Program, is in charge of estimating how many pledges it will take to make that goal. The world, he says, has to cut its annual greenhouse gas emissions by 12 gigatons.
A gigaton of emissions are roughly the emissions produced by Japan in 1 year.
So you need to find 12 Japans where you can flip off the light switch.
12 Japans, or another way of looking at it is that if you add up all the greenhouse gas emissions from all of the power plants in the world, in fact, the whole energy supply sector of the world, you get about 12 gigatons right now per year.
So actually you throw off the world's light switch.
For example.
When Alcamo totals up all the world's unconditional pledges to cut pollution, he gets 3 gigatons. That's about 1/4 of what he says is needed. Then there are the pledges with conditions attached, like, we'll cut more if the other developed countries are willing to do it. Or, we'll cut more on paper if you let us buy pollution credits.
If they pursue their most ambitious pledges, which are already down on paper, we could reduce that by considerably more. We could reduce that by 7 gigatons.
I guess my question is, the Kyoto Protocol, you have legally binding targets. Not every country was able to make those when they were legally binding. Here you've got a best case scenario where you count on every country making its voluntary, unenforceable pledge. Isn't your best case scenario a little optimistic?
Well, we're just good old scientists, you realize.
So there you have it. The planet has already crossed a tipping point. We are heading towards a world that is missing its ice caps, missing its glaciers, and missing a whole lot of islands and coastal cities. The world's leaders say they're going to fix it by running a pledge drive. That pledge drive is a little over 40% short, and it's looking like a lot of people won't pay their pledge. Which leads to a pretty obvious question. This is the best we can do? That's the question we're tackling in this series. If global warming is so serious, then what's holding us back? Our inquiry starts at the Moon Palace Resort Hotel Complex in Cancun, Mexico, where diplomats from every country have gathered for what is possibly the world's most important pledge drive. Environmental groups have been at these talks for years. They've tried lobbying. They have tried protesting. On this particular day, members of the Indigenous Environmental Network are praying.
Wind. Great Spirit, Earth Mother, we come to you at this time. We're looking into each of the directions, each of the six.
A few hundred feet away, rising sea levels and intense hurricanes have made the beach disappear twice in the last 10 years. Mexico's government has spent tens of millions of dollars pumping new sand onto the coast to replace it. At the entrance to the hotel, there are about 50 people at a vigil, sweating under the tropical sun.
At this time, that this United Nations grow ears to listen to the wisdom of the indigenous people. We're asking at this time that the United Nations opens its eyes to be able to see the destruction that is happening to our Mother Earth, to the air and to the waters.
But the protests and the prayers have largely gone unanswered. Inside, dark-suited negotiators for the world's nations pace air-conditioned marble halls.
Without the full participation of these major emitters, we cannot tackle with the real issue.
Politically, it's impossible to negotiate with people that actually said, no, I will not do anything, I can do anything. I mean, how could you negotiate with countries that are taking those positions?
Nothing binding will come out of here, in my opinion. And if it did, it would be rejected by the American people.
That last voice is Republican Senator James Inhofe, speaking exactly 1 year prior. Inhofe flew to the 2009 climate talks in Cancun for one purpose, to promise that his party would kill any climate change bill that arrived in the U.S. Senate.
We're not going to pass anything if it's either very economically harmful to the United States or if the developing countries didn't have to do the same thing that the developed countries.
For the past 10 years, this has more or less been the main argument out of the United States. We won't cut our emissions unless everyone cuts their emissions, which sounds reasonable until you consider how much less pollution poor countries emit.
If developing countries reduce emissions, where do they reduce it?
Bernadetas Mueller is a special advisor on climate change to the South Center. That's a think tank funded by the governments of about 50 nations in the global South.
Food production, infrastructure development, basic services for the people. What we want is just a decent standard of living.
This is the major fault line in climate talks. Fossil energy is cheap. It was the ticket to development for the countries that are wealthy today. And even though every nation agrees it is in their long-term interest to give up fossil fuels, most don't seem to think it's in their short-term interest to go first. Patrick Bond directs the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa.
Each of these countries is looking at the kind of big public investments that are going to be needed, and they're also looking at fiscal crises. And those kinds of combinations of economic crisis and climate crisis have made it pretty hard for a typical national state to say, well, we're going to allocate a bunch more money for public transport or for major renewable energy investments.
Fiscal challenges aside, there is also a basic problem of equity.
Well, this is the debt that the North owes the South.
Industrialized countries got wealthy by burning coal and oil over the past 200 years. Most of their greenhouse pollution is still in the air, which means that if every country gets to release only its fair share of pollution, then the rich ones have already overdrawn their accounts and emptied out the bank.
The South won't be able to industrialize as a result of the excessive emissions from the North. And the North has, in a sense, taken the carbon space from the South. And so $400 billion a year is what even the World Bank estimates.
That's the cost to poor nations of giving up their chance to develop the way we did, by burning fossil fuels. It also includes their estimated cost of coping with the impacts of climate change.
So whereas the North has done most of the emissions, it's countries in Africa, it's small island states, it's mountainous nations, it's countries that will be adversely affected the most by rising seawaters and by extreme storm surges. Those are the countries and the peoples that will be most adversely affected, and they're the ones that didn't cause the problem.
Consider the Polynesian nation of Tuvalu. Population, 12,000. Highest elevation, about 15 feet.
We have very limited land. And the sea level rise is already happening, and it's getting very, very serious.
Enele Sopala is Tuvalu's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Environment, and Labor.
Especially seawater intrusion into the ground, which impacts on our agricultural plants and so on, but also erosions is getting very, very serious. So we are getting very worried about these impacts.
The targeted levels of warming that are being discussed in these talks, 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees centigrade, what would they mean for Tuvalu?
On the 2 degrees, the impacts would be devastating. And I think not only IPCC, but also economic reviews, Professor Stern of UK in his report, identified this, the economically the situation will be catastrophic if we were to allow temperature to increase to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
When you say catastrophic, what do you mean?
Islands will just disappear. Communities and cultures, whole nations would disappear, including my own, Tuvalu.
Are you making plans to evacuate Tuvalu?
No. I think we are making plans to save Tuvalu with the help of the international community so that the people will remain in our islands. That's our plan.
But if you can't secure more ambitious action here, is there a plan for, is there a plan B?
The plan B is, of course, we remain there because it's at that stage, it's a different level. And I don't want to discuss it here because we want to get the international community to look constructively and realistically at the issue and work together to address the issue for the survival of these islands.
He's reluctant to talk about it at the talks where he wants to prevent climate change, but Tuvalu has already approached Australia and New Zealand to set up plans to evacuate the entire nation if there's an environmental emergency. That's right, their entire country. In the climate talks, Tuvalu is pushing for more aggressive temperature targets to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and it has forced the full 192-nation conference to discuss legally binding agreements to meet those measures, an extension of the Kyoto Protocol. But that discussion hasn't gotten very far.
Kyoto was legally binding, and everybody still fell short anyway.
Barack Obama, president of the world's largest contributor to global warming, explaining in 2009 why a pledge drive is the best he can do to fix it.
I actually think that it's necessary for us ultimately to get to such a treaty, and I am supportive of such efforts. But This is a classic example of a situation where if we just waited for that, then we would not make any progress.
While Tuvalu was forcing the countries in Copenhagen to debate aggressive action, Obama flew in for a last-minute meeting with some of the world's largest polluters. They formed their own agreement, that pledge drive called the Copenhagen Accord. Reaction from some of the world's more vulnerable countries was sharp.
President Obama, in acting the way he did, definitely eliminated any difference between him and the Bush tradition and era.
South Sudanese diplomat Stanislaus Lumumba Diaping was heading the G77 bloc of developing nations.
This accord is nothing but a political declaration. It's a spin. Industrialized nations have decidedly accepted that damage to developing countries is acceptable.
The United States is the world's largest historic contributor to global warming. Most countries argue it has a responsibility to lead cuts in greenhouse gas pollution. It also is the world's wealthiest nation, so they argue it has the most means to make those cuts. But under the Copenhagen Accord, the pledge drive arrangement brokered by the United States, the Obama administration has proposed making the developed world's least ambitious cuts. The administration argues this is the best they can do with the cards they have, with a Congress that won't pass climate legislation. But Obama hasn't exactly pressed the issue at home. Kumi Naidu is executive director of Greenpeace International.
President Obama stands, I think, legitimately to be criticized by us that he has not expended the kind of capital, for example, that he expended to get healthcare reform through Congress.
Why do you think there is so little political will from some of the large polluters?
Well, listen, if you want to call a spade, let's understand what's happening in the U.S. political system. Historically and presently, the most powerful lobby in the U.S. political system has been the oil and coal lobbies, the fossil fuel industry. And so unless American citizens recognize that they have to be in this struggle with the rest of the brothers and sisters around the world, that the lives of American children and future generations is just as much at risk as the lives of children in Africa and Asia, you know, we all are going to be impacted.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this program is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to the first of a special two-part series on how climate change is affecting the world now, produced by Brian Edwards Tekert.
So, there's one way of looking at climate negotiations. The U.S., the world's wealthiest, most powerful nation, isn't willing to lead, and the world's other large polluters, like China, they won't go it alone. Even though stopping climate change serves a collective interest, it is not in any one nation's short-term interest to swear off cheap fossil fuel energy. And since governments tend to worry about the next election, not the next generation, that's where the talks break down. But not every government sees things that way.
For us, going carbon neutral is not just the right thing to do. We believe it is in our economic self-interest.
That's Mohamed Nasheed, president of the Maldives. Top elevation? A little over 7 feet above sea level. He's explaining to activists outside the 2009 climate talks why his country has decided to eliminate or offset all of its greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2020.
Countries that have the foresight to green their economies today will be the winners of this century. These pioneering countries will free themselves from the unpredictable price of foreign oil. They will capitalize on the new green economy of the future. And they will enhance their moral standing, giving them greater political influence on the world stage.
So if Nasheed's right, if there is actually an economic self-interest in switching to a green economy, why isn't any other country doing it? Granted, the Maldives is special. It has a robust tourist economy driven by the island's natural beauty, so green is part of the brand. And fossil fuel is already very expensive there. They have to import every drop of oil they burn. Still, surely some other country would see an upside to joining them. There is an argument that in international talks, most governments don't actually represent their national self-interest or their people. Most voters don't watch these talks very closely. Rather, they represent their businesses and their elites.
Well, the oil companies largely and their friends in the petrochemical and automobile and weapons industries.
Teresa Turner is an economist who specializes in studying crude oil. She's at Canada's University of Guelph.
In the early 80s, I was employed in the United Nations in New York in a newly founded energy unit. Every time I went into my office in the morning, I'd have six oil company lobbyists offering to provide documentation, statistics, run data for me. This was before computers were really available. They had a huge amount of data capability, offering me interest-free mortgages if I wanted to buy a house in a posh area. And I would have none of it, but I can't say the same for my colleagues at the UN. And this is 30 years ago. Today, they're much more sophisticated.
So there are 194 countries here negotiating. How many do you think are in some way captive to petroleum interests?
I would say they're all captive.
In 2009, when the United States rolled out its Pledge Drive solution to climate change, there were howls of protest from some of the poorer nations. Tuvalu, Bolivia, and others blocked the conference from adopting that deal, the Copenhagen Accord. But over the course of the following year, more and more nations signed on, even poor and vulnerable countries like the Maldives. Patrick Bond directs the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa.
The problem with the least developed countries, as WikiLeaks showed from February 2010, is that they get bought pretty easily. Even the Maldives, for $50 million, sold out and reversed their position and said in February 2010 that they endorsed the Copenhagen Accord. We learned through WikiLeaks that this was because Todd Stern, Jonathan Pershing, Johnny Carson, some of the top State Department officials, were bribing, cajoling, and really blackmailing these poor little countries to do the Washington's bidding.
To be fair, the government of the Maldives contests that particular point. They say they agreed to the Copenhagen Accord early and on its own merits. The promises of aid from the U.S. came later. But they face the same predicament as many low-lying nations. It is already a given that sea levels will rise in the coming years. To survive, they'll need hundreds of millions of dollars to build seawalls, to reinforce buildings, to change their drinking water systems. Eventually, they may need money to relocate their entire populations. So they can't really afford to turn down foreign aid, which makes it very hard to go head-to-head with the countries that hand it out. That's why, Patrick Bond says, you can't fight climate change through international negotiations, at least not yet. So can climate campaigners actually achieve anything at the talks?
Nations are here looking at very microscopic national interest rather than looking at climate change as a global challenge.
That's Nemo Basse. He's chair of Friends of the Earth International.
Countries assembled in Cancun not to do anything about climate change, but to utilize the arguments of climate change as an opportunity for business and to continue polluting the world. They came here to ensure that industries can keep with the same paradigm of pollution, using fossil fuels to drive civilization, and not really caring what's going to happen tomorrow. And they got what they wanted.
But how many people did Friends of the Earth bring to the Cancun climate talks this year?
We came with a delegation of about just more than 70. At the beginning, about 200 more came with the caravans. So in all, we're close to 300.
And if, as you say, at the talks, business elites basically got what they wanted, do you think it's the best place to put your resources as an organization, bringing close to 300 people to them?
We could easily say, well, we turn our back on the entire system. But that would not stop the system. And we don't have an alternative space in which we can address the issues and get implemented actions taken to change the, to actually confront the challenges of the climate and of the planet. And so this space provides, as at now, the only avenue apart from the spaces created by social movements. And that the space of the social movement is actually very critical and very important. But as at now, we are not able to translate that into actions between nations to get things done.
That's not a very hopeful analysis. The only venue with the power to tackle climate change lacks the political will to do so. Patrick Bond says the answer is local politics, building pressure on the world's leaders through fights against coal mines and power plants, oil wells and refineries.
Environmental rights action in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, have been trying to block and actually quite successfully blocking oil extraction. At one point in 2008, they had more than half the oil extraction capacity actually blocked.
The 2011 round of climate talks will take place in Durban, South Africa, where Patrick Bond is based. He's helping to organize large street demonstrations. He sees that less of a way of influencing the negotiations than of showcasing the popular movements that he hopes will someday drive real change.
In Ecuador, at the Yasuni Park, the project there is to say, let's keep the oil in the soil in a major part of the Amazon that's under threat from extraction. And the government's even said, okay, well, if you can get the money together from a climate debt fund to keep us from extracting the oil, we should keep the oil in the soil. These are the sorts of inspirations around the world, and activists blocking extractive industries and across Africa, that's becoming very common now and in some places quite successful. Those are the things that we need to now start linking up and saying, this is the movement from below that's going to move forward, while the stagnation and the degradation, I think, of the negotiations in the UN and in the center of Durban continue to prove that the global elites don't have it within them to solve the problem.
But aren't there fundamental limits on actions that are targeted at local issues? In other words, you can keep the oil in the soil in Ecuador, but someone will just wind up pulling more out of the ground in Venezuela.
You're right. You can't simply have a local politics to solve a global problem. But you do nevertheless need a local grounded movement to develop the national level politics in each site. And before we change a lot of national states, I think it's premature to think about a global deal that'll really work.
Which stands to reason. All Bond's really saying is that until climate activists can win campaigns in their own countries, they don't have a chance of winning at the United Nations. There is, of course, one country in particular that gets blamed the most for stalling climate progress. It has pumped more greenhouse gases into the air than any other. It is the only country that refuses to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. And so, in our next installment of the series, we'll look at politics inside that keystone country, the United States. For Making Contact, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. The executive producer for this special two-part series on climate change is Claire Hope Cummings. This series was made possible by a grant by the LEA Fund, with additional support from the Cultural Conservancy and National Radio Project. Tune in next week for part two. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Con Pham, associate director, Kyungjin Lee and Esther Mania, producers, Carl Jogban Nunsing, volunteer coordinator, Lisa Bartfi, production intern, Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Alex Collins, Judy Huang, and Deshaw Moore, volunteers. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.